Hey everyone, this is Dr. Marie McNeely welcoming you to episode 236 of People Behind the Science. Our brilliant guest today is Dr. Pam Ronald. I appreciate you all taking the time to join us today, and I'll let you know we have a wonderful show on the way. And listeners, if you're like me and you have a mile-long books to read list, I think it's time to go ahead and add a few more to that list. Our guests have been giving us so many awesome recommendations, and we're keeping a list on our website at www.peoplebehindthescience.com/resources. So find your next great book there. And now on to our show. Pam has some phenomenal insights to share with us today, so I hope you are ready to meet another one of our exceptional people behind the science.
Every day, discoveries are made that will change our understanding of the world around us. Dr. Marie McNeely is here to bring you the brilliant minds who are making these discoveries so they can share their incredible stories and take you on an amazing journey. Welcome to People Behind the Science.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of People Behind the Science. Today, I am excited to introduce you all to Dr. Pam Ronald. So thank you for joining us today, Pam. How are you?
Fine. It's a pleasure to join you.
Well, we are delighted to have you on our program. And listeners, I'm excited to tell you about Pam. She is a professor in the Department of Plant Pathology and the Genome Center at the University of California, Davis. She's also the director of the UC Davis Institute for Food and Agricultural Literacy, director of the GRAS Genetics at Joint Bioenergy Institute, and co-founder of Biology Fortified Incorporated, an educational nonprofit organization. Now, Pam received her master's degree in biology from Stanford, as well as a master's degree in plant physiology from the University of Uppsala in Sweden. Her PhD was awarded from UC Berkeley in molecular and physiological plant biology. And afterward, Pam conducted postdoctoral research at Cornell University before joining the faculty there at Davis. Now, Pam is the recipient of many honors and awards, including the USDA 2008 National Research Initiative Discovery Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Fulbright Tocqueville Distinguished Chair, the National Association of Science Writers Science and Society Journalism Award, the Lewis Molasses International Scientific Prize for Agriculture and Food, and the Tech Award in 2012. In addition, she has been elected to the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And Pam and her husband have also co-authored the book, Tomorrow's Table, Organic Farming, Genetics, and the Future of Food. Now, Pam is here with all of us today to tell us about her journey through life and science. So Pam, today, myself and our listeners want to get to know you, both as a scientist, but also as a person. So can you start off by telling us what you like to do when you're not doing science?
Well, when I'm not doing science, I like to work in the garden and cook. My husband's a farmer, so we have lots of fresh food around here. And in the wintertime, we do tend to ski quite a bit, and we swim too. This is California. We get to do both.
Wonderful. Well, do you have a preferred or a favorite crop that you and your husband grow there?
Well, we do eat a lot of kale, my husband's favorite dish.
Very good. I love kale. Well, wonderful to hear a little bit about your life outside of science, Pam. But can you tell us next about your work and how you describe what you do to someone who's not in science?
Well, I study rice. And what my laboratory does is try to understand what makes rice resistant to disease and tolerant of environmental stress. So plants, like people, get infections, viral infections, bacterial infections, and it's really important for farmers that they can plant crop varieties that can withstand these disease-causing agents, because otherwise they have to spray pesticides. So I've been interested in this in a very long time, and so we, a number of years ago, identified a gene and rice that makes the plant completely resistant to a devastating bacterial infection. And it was really exciting to learn that this particular gene in the plant is very similar to genes in humans as well that help humans resist infection.
Very interesting work, Pam. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of your research throughout the interview. But great to get a little snapshot of what you do in the lab at work. And now I'm curious to hear about some of the people who've impacted you and been a big influence in your career. So we always like to talk about role models on this program. Do you have any particular people who really jump up in your mind as role models?
Well, certainly my parents. My father's an immigrant and always encouraged us to do our best in school and in life. And that has been very important, and seeing how he's made his way through the world and in some very difficult circumstances, I think has always inspired us and my siblings and our children. And of course, my mother, who's a fabulous environmentalist, activist, and really excellent cook and gardener and wonderful human beings. So they really have been fantastic role models for me.
Wonderful to hear. I think it's so important for people, particularly scientists, to have these role models, these inspirational figures going through life, because I think you do run into a lot of challenges as a scientist. So it's nice to have these people who you can look up to, who've made it through a lot of adversity and difficult situations. So can you take us back now to the very beginning, Pam, and tell us what got you excited about science in the first place and how you started down this path?
Well, I think it was probably growing up in summers in the Sierra Nevada mountains. So my parents bought a little plot of land for $2,000 in Lake Tahoe, and my dad bought a kit and he built a cabin for $5,000, and we all crammed in there, about 500 square feet.
Oh, wow.
And we spent all summer up there and many, many winters. And my parents were very free with us. So we'd go out for days just walking through the mountains, looking at flowers, hiding under tarps from the rain and the hail when needed. And it was just really fabulous. So I think it was such a part of my childhood that I've always been very connected to the natural world and also aware of so much environmental destruction in the world. As I've grown up, we grew up across the street from a huge, beautiful oak woodland, 1,000 acres that we'd roam around. And over the years, it has been completely converted to an urban environment, and that was very difficult. And my mother grew up in Iowa. Her parents were very interested in agriculture, and she also. So I've always been very fascinated with plants and food. And then when I went to college, it really had a big impact on me learning about genetics, which is a really sort of mathematically oriented. And I really loved the beauty of genetics to explain a lot of the traits that we see in humans and plants. And so I've been very fortunate in my career to be able to pull a lot of those threads in my life together and work on developing crop varieties that use less land, less water, fewer insecticides, and work with a lot of fabulous people.
Fantastic. Well, Pam, it's great to hear about your sort of early connection with the natural world and how things seem to fall into place with this love of agriculture, this interest in genetics, everything building up to your career in science. Now, I love this description of yourself as a child kind of being out in the wilderness. Did your parents teach you a lot of these sort of survival skills, or was it stuff you sort of picked up on your own?
We pretty much taught ourselves. You know, you learn to survive when you get up there and it starts hailing and you forgot to bring your plastic tarp. And you learn because, you know, you put your sleeping bag in a nice, soft, low point and you wake up and it's flooded. All the water has rolled underneath you.
Mm-hmm.
So we definitely learned.
You learn the hard way sometimes. Yeah.
And we would bring heavy, heavy foods. And then we learned, oh, it's hard to get up the hill. So we learned then to dry a lot of our foods actually ourselves before we would take off on our trips. So it's really lovely in California because, of course, the climate is very mild and it's pretty rare in the summer when you're threatened by a very, very severe storm.
Well, that is very cool, Pam, and wonderful to hear about your journey to get to where you are today. But can you tell us a little bit more about one of these projects that you're working on now that you are maybe the most excited about?
Well, I'm still very, very excited about understanding how plants resist disease. And we spent a lot of time early years of my career trying to understand what are the genes and proteins that resist disease. And we discovered a protein called a receptor that we hypothesized sort of hung around on the outside of the cell waiting for the microbe to come along, and then it would recognize the microbe and send sort of an alarm through the cell, which would allow the plant to resist disease. And so we spent a lot of time also trying to then understand, well, what is the microbial molecule that the plant recognizes? So we're really excited about those results, because we now have the partners, both the plant partner and the microbial partner, and we know how they interact with each other and what sets off the signaling system. So that continues to be very, very exciting. And of course, it's important for agriculture, because if you can introduce these genes into crops, then you don't need to spray pesticides. And virtually everything we eat has genes for resistance, and they're very, very important for farmers. And actually, we've been breeding for these genes for over 100 years, and it was really only the last 20 years that we understand what these genes are and what they do. So that's always been very interesting to me. And I'm also very excited about a collaboration I've been involved in for almost 20 years now. So plants also are very prone to reductions in yield when they're stressed. So, for example, drought, and people often think of drought when they think of global climate change, because actually I just read today, 2014 was the hottest year in record. And it's not only a problem during your commute, but it's a problem for plants, because they will yield much less when it's so hot. But another problem associated with global climate change is, in some parts of the world, flooding has grown to be much worse, and that includes places like Bangladesh and India. So 20 years ago, a colleague of mine had talked to me. He and his student had identified sort of in a rough location on the rice genome that there was a really unusual trait that allowed a rice plant to stay underwater for 2 weeks and then survive the flood. And most rice plants will die after 3 days. So we thought if we could isolate the gene for tolerance to flooding, then we might be able to introduce it into varieties grown by farmers in Bangladesh and India. And in fact, we were really excited. We were able to isolate this gene, and then breeders at the International Rice Research Institute developed several varieties that have been very, very popular with farmers. 4 million farmers now are growing this new variety.
Wow.
And they're able to harvest threefold more rice grain after floods. And so this is really important, because many of these farmers live on less than $2 a day, and two-thirds of their total calories come from rice. So this continues to be a very exciting project.
Now, your work has a great impact on agriculture. Is this something where you find yourself working closely with farmers to identify their problems and kind of help them address them? Or how does that work in terms of collaborating with farmers?
So the plant research community is global, and we're all connected, and especially I would say the rice community. I've been very fortunate early in my career to have funding by the Rockefeller Foundation, and their goal really was to connect scientists, geneticists in the developed world with farmers in the less developed world, and they would have meetings every year where we could get together. And it was really important for me, because growing up in California, I wasn't familiar with farmers growing rice. Although we do grow rice in California, it's a different kind of system, because they're not subsistence farmers. And so through my collaboration with many people, including David McKill, who's also here at the University of California, Davis, he really taught me about some of these very difficult challenges faced by farmers, such as flooding. And he carried out several years of field tests with the new rice varieties that him and his collaborators developed. And I was fortunate to join the team to visit the farmers and really hear and learn about their challenges and any questions they had about the new variety. And also, very importantly, to learn from them about how this particular variety was performing in their fields.
Well, it's wonderful to hear that you've had some of these opportunities to really speak directly with some of the people who are being directly impacted by your work. So phenomenal opportunity. Now, we've talked about a lot of the great things about careers in science and some of the exciting opportunities that you've had along your journey. We haven't yet talked about some of the challenges, some of the failures, some of the struggles. And I know every scientist has their own share, sometimes more than their fair share. And sometimes these struggles go on for days, weeks, months on end. So can you take us back to a point in your career, Pam, where you struggled with something, or maybe you had a major failure, and tell us what happened and what are some of these steps that you took to get through it?
Well, I do happen to have a very good story there, a very recent story, in fact. In 2009, we published a paper in Science Magazine, which we were very excited about, and it relates to this communication between plants and microbes. I have always been very interested in trying to understand sort of this dialogue between plants and microbes, how they can sense the presence of each other. And we reported that we had isolated a microbial molecule that was recognized by the plant. And we published this, and a couple years later, we wanted to build on this work. We were very excited about it. And my postdoctoral fellows and graduate students started noticing that there were some experiments they could not reproduce. And this is very, very difficult for anybody, but I think especially for a scientist. And we spent 18 months trying to figure out, you know, were we not able to do the experiments anymore for some sort of technical reason, or were the results we published wrong? And to make a very long story short, we discovered that we had published information that was wrong. And this was a really very difficult time, as you can imagine. There, some of my graduate students and postdoctoral fellows had come to the lab to specifically work on this project. And so they were faced with loss of months of work and uncertain about where to go with their careers. And it was very difficult. But in some way, I was lucky because the former lab members that had carried out this work stayed in touch with us. They helped us work through the problems. And ultimately, when I decided we needed to retract the paper, everybody was willing to sign on to the retraction. And so that was a good thing. But then what was even better, so we were very discouraged because, you know, you're looking to go back to where you were years before.
Right. And back to the drawing board, yeah.
Yeah, you're sort of lost in the cloud and you've lost faith in some of your scientists. You've lost faith in, you know, your ability to manage the science, and you have to recreate a lot of the assays. And we were very, very discouraged, but we hung in there. And just last week, we submitted a paper describing isolation of the very microbial molecule that we were looking for in the first place. And so we are very excited about this. And it really wouldn't have come this far if I hadn't had just a really fabulous, hardworking team. And not only scientifically hardworking, but psychologically strong to make it through this. Nobody gave up. And that turning out to be one of the most amazing experiences of my career.
So what were some of the things that kept you and maybe your lab members as well going, you know, once you realized that there were problems and you had to sort of look at this sea of work in front of you that you had to do to start sorting them out? What kept you guys motivated and going and working on this?
Well, the science always keeps you going. I mean, we are such scientists. So first, well, you can't sleep if you don't know yourself what went wrong, what was right, what was wrong. And so we were driven to try to figure out where the mistakes had been made. And ultimately, we were able to figure that out. And that was very important to us because we didn't want other laboratories reading our work and repeating the same mistakes. So, you know, that kind of drives you to just to get it right. And then, you know, what are you going to do that? I mean, you do want to kind of crawl under your bed and give up, but it's pretty lonely and boring under the bed.
The problem's not going to go away if you hide from it.
Yeah, and so we just plotted our way through. You know, we very quickly, actually, all the team members were able to lay out the experiments that we needed to do. And we just did them. And slowly but surely, it was almost like we slowly warmed up to the possibility, again, of making discoveries. And that was very exciting, because that is one of the things that drives scientists forward, is it's very exciting to discover something new about the natural world. And yeah, so that's what we did.
Certainly. So did you find that you were very sort of paranoid with the next paper, you know, double checking everything lots of times? I know I would definitely be that way. And I think that's a fear that a lot of scientists have.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we checked and double checked and did this experiment and that experiment. We had the experiments replicated by different lab members in different countries. We looked at it from really every possible angle before we submitted it. I mean, often scientists will make a mistake in their submission of their paper, but usually the peer review will catch it, mm-hmm. or one of the reviewers will catch it. And it was really shocking to me that we didn't catch the results before publication, because that's what you're supposed to do, catch it before
right.
publication. So this time we were indeed very, very careful. Well, we were careful before too, but we made mistakes.
Right. And I think that's something, this is an important experience to talk about, because like I said, this is a big fear for a lot of scientists. You know, it's something that grad students, I think, have nightmares about, is, you know, getting these results, being so excited about them, publishing them, and then realizing they're wrong, whether it's, you know, in a presentation at a conference or someone commenting on your journal article. And I think it's a problem in science, this fear of being wrong. I mean, it's important to the system to ensure that accurate information is getting out there. But I think sometimes it can be a problem if people are afraid to make these jumps, afraid to ask big questions, because I think it can sort of stifle progress in some cases. But I'm so glad you shared this story with us today, Pam. And we don't just want to talk about the tough times. So can you tell us next about one of these success stories coming from your career or your lab? And it can be a big success or even just a little victory along the way.
Yeah, well, certainly the big successes are probably those moments that I briefly mentioned already. I mean, it was very, very exciting when we were finally convinced that we actually had the right microbial molecule, and actually our original model was accurate. We just had to find the right molecule. So certainly that has been a very, very exciting time for the lab. And we do believe we'll be able to publish this result. I mean, you never know through the review process. It may change. It may go from one journal to the next. But we're very confident that we will be able to publish it and build upon it. And there's some aspects of this discovery that have driven us to investigate other areas that open new doors for us. And certainly, it was really very exciting the first day that, you know, we had spent 10 years trying to identify a gene for some MERS tolerance that was very important for farmers. And really the day that we had developed these new plants in our lab carrying this gene, and to see that they were completely tolerant of submergence was astonishing. And then to see the breeders at the International Rice Research Institute move forward and take something from the laboratory and move it into the field, into the hands of farmers, has also been very, very exciting to me. I think most scientists, we don't want discoveries to remain in the lab. We want to be able to enhance the quality of life for people. And so I'm very grateful for the work that the breeders did and the many years of field tests they conducted to get this new gene into the hands of farmers. So those are all exciting, and I have to say, probably the first big discovery of my career, along with my collaborators, also was very exciting, discovering one of the first genes for resistance, to finally understand why plants were resistant, what made plants resistant to some pests and disease, and why were some plants susceptible. And so there was actually a huge hunt for many years, plant biologists in many labs trying to figure out what these genes were. And many of the genes were discovered all within a 3-year period. And so there was just such tremendous excitement in the field. We were always calling each other up and describing how, finding out the genes were very similar and some were somewhat different. And then on top of that, right after the plant biology community had discovered genes for resistance, the animal biology community discovered similar genes for resistance. And that was really amazing, I think, to both plant and animal biologists. And then for me, what was very exciting too is one of the animal biologists is my third cousin. And so I've had a great pleasure in becoming reacquainted with him through science.
Oh, that is wonderful. The family science connection. I like it. Well, Pam, you are describing just an incredible amount of perseverance here in your particular field and really in science in general, I think, in a lot of cases, spending 10 years investigating this one particular root gene. So what was going through your mind? What were you thinking that one day when you finally started seeing it and understanding it?
Well, you know, during that process of 10 years, it's always difficult too because you need to support the people doing the work. And so there was a really fantastic, hardworking postdoc named Kanang Shu that started this work in my collaborator Dave McKill's lab and then worked in my laboratory. And Dave and I struggled to find funding for him because in science, sometimes the predicted results are so remote that it's hard to convince funding agencies that it really is important. But so when we did finally find the gene, he finally found the gene, and when we saw how strong a response it really was definitely a very exciting time.
Well, that is wonderful to hear about some of these exciting discoveries and wonderful times in your career and exciting discoveries that are coming out of your own lab, the work that you guys are sort of tirelessly doing there. And I know scientists spend so much time working on the research. It doesn't always leave time for them to enjoy all the other things they like to do in life. But I've talked to so many scientists who are quite avid readers. So, Pam, I'd love to get a book recommendation from you today, a book that you've read and really enjoyed. And it can be a science book or a non-science book.
Well, I did just finish listening to The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt on Books on Tape, mm-hmm. and it starts off a little slow and a little grim and a little repetitive, but then it gets to be very, very exciting and good, and I just loved her. She created these really fabulous characters in her book and really fantastic dialogue and really told the story of how random life is, that, you know, you can't just predict where your life is going to go and how it's going to go. And I thought she captured that really well in the book.
Excellent recommendation. I know, I think I've heard a couple other people recommend it as well. So this means I need to bump it up on my to-read list. I love it.
To try to get through the beginning is a little nasty.
Maybe skip the first 30 pages or so. Well, Pam, great recommendation for our listeners out there. And one of the other wonderful aspects of careers in science that we haven't had a chance to chat about are some of the opportunities that scientists get to travel. So you mentioned that you collaborate sort of internationally in this plant community with farmers, with other scientists. Can you think back now on all the places that you've traveled to for science and tell us about your favorite place and why it's so memorable?
Well, favorite's hard to say, but I probably spend most of my time abroad in France, and that's really a historical reason more than a scientific reason. My father is a refugee, a Jewish refugee, and spent 12 years escaping the Nazis. And he did spend 7 years of his life in Paris, and he stayed there until the Germans invaded, and then they fled to southern France, eventually to Cuba and then the United States. So I've been fortunate to actually benefit from his difficult life in the sense that him and his father always wanted me to learn French and became very interested in French. And so I've spent a couple of years living in France and a year living in Sweden, and so have spent quite a bit of time in Europe. And of course, I always like to go back there. And I was very fortunate because for a couple of years I lived there, I was able to work in a laboratory in Toulouse in southern France, and then mm-hmm. on a separate occasion work in Montpellier, where they do a lot of rice research. And that's, I think, really enriched my life to live there and meet scientists there.
Sure. So are there certain things that you've noticed that are maybe similar or different across these labs in different places, so in Europe and other countries?
Oh, yeah. So we're not allowed to smoke in our labs in France.
You are?
There used to be a lot of smoking. I mean, there's just
really?
Okay, my French colleagues will not like that. But when I lived there, well, it's starting to be a little bit different. But when I lived there and worked there for the first time, I was actually pregnant, and so I was very sensitive to the smoke. I mean, it was just sort of accepted. That's what you do. You smoke. So there's just funny things like that. But scientifically, globally. This is what I like about science. It really is a global community. We have the same values and we really work together to get things right, to reproduce our work, to communicate, to collaborate, to learn from each other. And that's really one of the best things about science is you have a scientific language that draws you together across cultures. It's its own type of language and passion that is very similar. It doesn't really matter what nationality you are. We can always communicate.
Well, very cool to hear about these experiences that you've had working in science abroad. And I think, you know, throughout these different groups that you work with over the years, it's interesting to think about the differences in culture and personality and traditions that happen across the different labs. And I think a lot of labs that I've at least had the experience working in have some quirky traditions that go along with them, or even just some really funny memories that you've shared with your colleagues. So can you tell us about one of these traditions or memories today, Pam?
Some traditions that aren't always safe. I used to take my lab up to Tahoe and we'd go hiking. And once I'll never forget this, we had this idea, look at this nice snowfield. It was summer. Let's slide down the snowfield. Mm-hmm. And we were walking over to the snowfield and my lead postdoc slipped and started barreling down. And we thought he was going to kill himself on the rocks below. So I almost lost somebody there. And then in another one of our lab trips to Tahoe, we were overloaded a canoe and paddling offshore and having a grand old time. And then we flipped the canoe and we all started laughing until my leading lab manager said, I can't swim.
Oh, no.
I work with a lot of people from China and a lot of people have not had the opportunity for swim lessons when they were young. And so this was really a shock. And there he was trying to hold his new watch out of the water so it wouldn't get wet. And
priorities.
And the dogs and the boat. But we did get him to safety. And that's also a very strong memory. So now I'm actually much more careful in my old age when I take my lab group up on an adventure like that.
That sounds somewhat reminiscent of your almost survival stories of being a child kind of going through the wilderness. I love it.
Yeah, I forgot that not everybody grew up just randomly in the woods. And yeah, you have to be careful with people.
Understand. Well, we had a swimming pool. My parents threw me in the lake when I was a kid, so I can definitely swim. But
you sort of take for granted or you forget that people can't swim, but it's actually quite common in some countries not to learn to swim. And so I try to be very careful now around water.
Well, those sound like incredible lab memories, bonding experiences to share with these people, kind of getting outside the lab, spending time together. And I think that's what makes the lab community so great in a lot of places is forming these relationships with the people there and not just talking about work all the time. So great to hear about the environment that you've built in your own lab. And Pam, I think one of the things that scientists love to chat about, in addition to some of the research that they're working on right now, is some of the big questions that they'd like to answer if they could answer anything. So I loved getting into these hypothetical kinds of questions. So can you tell us today, if we gave you everything, Pam, if things like funding and staff and technology and feasibility were not an issue, what is the one question that you are dying to know the answer to?
How to feed the world without further destroying the environment. That's really what we're trying to do, and many people are trying to do, and it's really a critical question of our time.
So what are some of the biggest things that you see as barriers in answering this question?
I mean, of course there are scientific barriers. I mean, it is one of the goals is to try to figure out how to keep plants, make them resistant for a long period of time. So most of the crop varieties that are planted, they might be resistant for a short while to a particular disease, but then another disease will come in and that crop will no longer be resistant. And so there's different types of diversity approaches one can use to try to reduce vulnerability to disease. So there are definitely important agronomic things that people can do, right? Plant-resistant varieties, use sort of an integrative crop management system, do crop rotation. There's a lot of things we can do. But I think possibly even a bigger challenge is to try to help non-farmers understand the challenges of farmers. So in the United States, something like 1 to 2% of the population are farmers. And then there's 98% that are not so familiar with farming. I really think it would be really great if we can get farmers to talk to people in the urban environments more often and to try to explain the kind of challenges they face, to explain the kinds of practices they use in the United States, also to explain why they use genetically engineered crops, because this is a seed variety. It's been used for about 20 years, these types of seeds. It's not really that new, but there's a growing sort of emotional reaction to this concept of genetic engineering. And I think it would really be helpful if consumers could talk directly with farmers and understand what it means to a farmer when they're able to reduce their insecticide use tenfold by using one of these new varieties. And I think that's something that I also want to help work on, to bring these communities together, to get really open and transparent discussions and have those discussions be anchored in science instead of fear.
Well, I think you brought up some really great points there, Pam. And I know I really admire farmers. I killed an aloe plant. I'm so terrible with gardening. You know, I think they have definitely a lot of work cut out for them in providing food for the world and answering this big question that you pointed out. You know, how can you feed the world without having these detrimental effects on the environment? I think it's going to be so important with our global population continuing to increase over the years. So fantastic questions for myself and our listeners to ponder. And now, Pam, is there any other last piece of advice or maybe one last piece of inspiration that you want to leave our listeners with today?
Where I live, you know, surrounded by all kinds of wonderful people, and in the Central Valley here, we have farmers here grow half the fruits, nuts, and vegetables for the entire United States. And, you know, it's easy to take for granted this abundance, and it's easy to perhaps want more of something or feel you're going to complain about something. And I sort of like this quote I heard recently about, you know, it's just icing on the cake. So we've got the cake. Maybe we don't always have the icing on the cake that we want, but we've got the cake. And just to have that sense of gratitude for what we do have, I think that's been really important to me.
Well, Pam, I really like that motivational quote. And I think you probably don't realize how much of a fan of cake I am myself, but
yeah, me too.
Absolutely. You definitely have to appreciate what you have, that cake. And you might not have everything you want. And I think you're never going to have everything you want. It's just sort of human nature to always want more. But wonderful thing to keep in your mind as you're going through, to have these senses of gratitude, these feelings of appreciating what you do have. Well, Pam, can you tell our listeners today now how they can reach out to get in touch with you if they have any questions or want to learn more about your research?
Sure. I have a website, cropgeneticsinnovation.org, and there's a lot of information on my website, and there's also information on how to contact me as well.
Fantastic. Well, Pam, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing a piece of your story.
Well, thank you.
And thank you to our listeners out there. We'll see you next time on another episode of People Behind the Science. Your voyage to the lives of today's exceptional scientists has just begun. You can find everything we talked about today, including our guests' favorite books, biographies, photos, and more, when you visit us at www.peoplebehindthescience.com. I look forward to seeing you next time on People Behind the Science.